Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I better correct something right away. I'm no longer teaching anywhere. I just stopped teaching everywhere in June so that I could devote my time to poetry and visits such as this. And it never was Columbia University, no. Columbia College in Chicago, something very different indeed. Carl Sandburg, my predecessor as poet laureate of Illinois, Carl Sandburg, now perhaps whimsically whirling where he is, had at least 38 fascinating definitions for poetry, and I'd like to share a few of those with you. He said, poetry is a sliver of the moon lost in the belly of a golden frog. Poetry is the opening and closing of a door, leaving those who look through to guess about what is seen during a moment. Poetry is a pack sack of invisible keepsakes. Poetry is a fresh morning spider web telling a story of moonlit hours of weaving and waiting during a night. And this one I think maybe a good many of you have heard. Poetry is the achievement of the synthesis of hyacinths and biscuits. All those are very exciting and elaborate, sometimes technical. And I have just one to offer when I'm challenged. What is poetry, as I often am? And it is, poetry is life distilled. That's very easy to say and quick to say. Poetry is life distilled. And I firmly believe that poetry is a distillation of life, the poet's life, and what he observes, which is a part of his experience. And a poet is one who distills experience, then crystallizes until the product can be held familiarly in the hand. And my offering today will be first the distillation of my own experience as I have packed it into my poetry. And next, the distillation of the experience and observation of the new young black poets of today. And I hope that many of you are familiar with some of them. And if not, I think you'll find what they're doing a very exciting thing. But first, my own. And I'd like to begin with a poem called Kitchenette Building. And this is the distillation of the experience of my husband and myself when we were young and lived in a little series of kitchenette apartments. I don't know if you have such things here in Poughkeepsie. Poughkeepsie, the part of it that I've seen, looks very nice and gentle and genteel indeed. So perhaps you don't have such things as kitchenette buildings. But in Chicago and in many other cities that I know of, there are these kitchenette apartments. You'll find four or five, perhaps, on one floor in what should be only one apartment. And the total impact, the total impression of living of that kind seemed to my husband and myself to be a grayness, a constricted, tight grayness. And I hope I've put that quality into this poem. We are things of dry hours and the involuntary plan, grayed in and gray. Dream makes a giddy sound, not strong like rent, feeding a wife, satisfying a man. But could a dream send up through onion fumes, its white and violet, fight with fried potatoes and yesterday's garbage ripening in the hall, flutter or sing an aria down these rooms? Even if we were willing to let it in, had time to warm it, keep it very clean, anticipate a message, let it begin. We wonder, but not well, not for a minute, since number 5 is out of the bathroom now. We think of lukewarm water, hope to get in it. And many's the time we did wait in impatience outside the door. The next poem is called The Mother, and it is not about that kind of mother whom most of us will soon be celebrating on Mother's Day, but a mother nevertheless. Abortions will not let you forget. You remember the children you got that you did not get. The damp, small pulse with a little or with no hair. The singers and workers that never handled the air. You will never neglect or beat them, or silence or buy with a sweet. You will never wind up the sucking thumb, or scuttle off ghosts that come. You will never leave them controlling your luscious sigh, return for a snack of them with gobbling mother eye. I have heard in the voices of the wind the voices of my dim kill children. I have contracted. I have eased my dim dears at the breast they could never suck. I have said, sweets, if I sinned, if I seized your lives and your luck in your lives from your unfinished reach, if I stole your births and your names, your straight baby tears and your games, your stilted or lovely loves, your tumults, your marriages, aches, and your deaths, if I poison the beginnings of your breaths, believe that even in my deliberateness, I was not deliberate. Though why should I whine? Whine that the crime was other than mine, since anyhow you are dead, or rather, or instead, you were never made. But that too, I am afraid, is faulty. Oh, what shall I say? How is the truth to be said? You were born, you had body, you died. It is just that you never giggled, or planned, or cried. Believe me, I loved you all. Believe me, I knew you, though faintly, and I loved you all. Impressive in my early experience when I was a little girl was a certain preacher who said pretty much the same thing Sunday after Sunday, thus leaving his mind free to ruminate as it chose, it seemed to me, and to others of my time. And I thought just possibly he might have ruminated thus. I think it must be lonely to be God. Nobody loves a master. No, despite the bright hosannas, bright dear lords, and bright determined reverence of Sunday eyes. Picture Jehovah striding through the hall of his importance. Creatures running out from servant corners to acclaim, to shout appreciation of his merits glare. But who walks with him, dares to take his arm, to slap him on the shoulder, tweak his ear, buy him a Coca-Cola or a beer, poo-poo his politics, call him a fool? Perhaps, who knows, he tires of looking down. Those eyes are never lifted, never straight. Perhaps sometimes he tires of being great in solitude, without a hand to hold. But that, of course, is a ministerial rumination, not a Gwendolinian one, ostensibly. In these days of pollution, and crime in the streets and general dissatisfaction and agitation. Sometimes perhaps we say to ourselves, why go on? What is there to go on toward? And here is at least one possible answer to the question, shall we go on? The contemplation of suicide, the temptation of Timothy. One poses at track or range or river, saying, what is the fact of my life? To what do I tend? And is it assured and sweet that I have come after mazes and robins, after the foodless swallowings and snatchings at fog, to this foppish inn, knowing that downtown the sluggish shrug their shoulders, slink, talk. Then, though one can think of no fact, no path, no ground, some little thing remarkless and daily relates its common cliché. One lunges or lags on, prates, too selfish to be nothing, while beams break, surf's epileptic, chicken reeks or squalls. This poem is called Negro Hero, to suggest Dory Miller. Dory Miller was a hero of Pearl Harbor Day in World War II. And instead of staying downstairs with the vegetables, which is what he was supposed to do, because in those days there was not integration of the forces, the armed forces, and he wasn't supposed to concern himself with weapons. And he had had no training in the use of the machine gun, but when the excitement began upstairs, this was on the SS Virginia, I believe, he rose to the unoffered challenge and saved the lives of his captain and other officers. And I tried to interpret in this poem what his feelings might have been if he'd had time to entertain such things as feelings, conscious feelings. The poem, as you see, is called Negro Hero, and that is what that's the word we used in those days. This poem was written, in 1944, I believe. And Negro was the fashionable word then, but now you all know, don't you, that that's no longer fashionable. The word now is black, which is clean and inclusive. It pulls in the blacks in Africa and the blacks here and the blacks wherever they may be, and I favor it myself. I had to kick their law into their teeth in order to save them. However, I have heard that sometimes you have to deal devilishly with drowning men in order to swim them to shore, or they will haul themselves and you to the trash and the fish beneath. When I think of this, I do not worry about a few chipped teeth. It is good I gave glory, it is good I put gold on their name, or there would have been spikes in the afterward hands. But let us speak only of my success and the pictures in the Caucasian dailies as well as the Negro weeklies, for I am a gem. They are not concerned that it was hardly the enemy my fight was against, but them. It was a tall time, and of course my blood was boiling about in my head and straining and howling and singing me on. Of course I was rolled on wheels of my boy itch to get at the gun. Of course all the delicate rehearsal shots of my childhood masked in mirage before me. Of course I was child, and my first swallow of the liquor of battle, bleeding, black air, dying, and demon noise made me wild. It was kinder than that, though, and I showed like a banner my kindness. I loved, and a man will guard when he loves. Their white-gowned democracy was my fair lady, with her knife lying cold, straight, in the softness of her sweet-flowing sleeve. But for the sake of the dear smiling mouth and the stuttered promise, I toyed with my life. I threw back. I would not remember entirely the knife. Still, am I good enough to die for them? Is my blood bright enough to be spilled? Was my constant back question. Are they clear on this? Or do I intrude even now? Am I clean enough to kill for them? Do they wish me to kill for them? Or is my place while death licks his lips and strides to them in the galley still? In a southern city, a white man said, indeed, I'd rather be dead. Indeed, I'd rather be shot in the head or ridden to waste on the back of a flood than saved by the drop of a black man's blood. Naturally, the important thing is I helped to save them and a part of their democracy, even if I had to kick their law into their teeth in order to do that for them. And I am feeling well and settled in myself because I believe it was a good job, despite this possible horror, that they might prefer the preservation of their law in all its sick dignity and their knives to the continuation of their creed and their lives. Thank you. Thank you. Here is an impudent little distillation from my own childhood called Old Relative. After the baths and bowel work, he was dead. Pillows no longer mattered, and getting fed, and anything that anybody said. Whatever was his, he never more strictly had, lying in long hesitation, good or bad, hypothesis, traditional, and fad. She went in there to muse on being rid of relative beneath the coffin lid. No one was by. She stuck her tongue out, slid. Since for a week she must not play Charmaine or a honey bunch or singing in the rain. The names of those songs will give a hint as to my age. Maybe some of you youngsters never heard of Honey Bunch. We real cool, the pool players, seven at the Golden Shovel. We real cool, we left school, we lurk late, we strike straight, we sing sin, we thin gin, we jazz June, we die soon. And this one is called The Bean Eaters, and it's the title poem of a volume of mine, The Bean Eaters. And when I was looking for a title for this book, I thought of The Potato Eaters, which of course I couldn't use, but I've always admired that painting of Van Gogh's showing people that he tried to make as potato-y looking as he could. And I said to myself, well, perhaps it's just as well that I consider beans, because beans go a lot farther in a large black family than potatoes. You can always add more water, and you've got more bowls of victuals. They eat beans mostly, this old yellow pair. Dinner is a casual affair. Plain chipware on a plain and creaking wood. Tin flatware. Two who are mostly good. Two who have lived their day, but keep on putting on their clothes and putting things away. And remembering with twinklings and twinges as they lean over the beans in their rented back room that is full of beads and receipts and dolls and cloths, tobacco crumbs, vases, and fringes. Between books, I would like to read to you a tiny, tiny story, which is apropos because it's been said many times that the fiction and the book reviews and anything else I write has a sort of poetic cast, and I think this is because I think in terms of poetry and can't help but consider every word that I write, even though it may be prose. I've been told this is not the way to write fiction. This little story is called The Life of Lincoln West, and I've been asked, is your hero James Baldwin? And the answer is no. Ugliest little boy that everyone ever saw. That is what everyone said. Even to his mother, it was apparent when the blue apron nurse came into the northeast end of the maternity ward, bearing his squeals and plump bottom looped up in a scant receiving blanket, bending to pass the bundle carefully into the waiting mother hands, that this was no cute little ugliness, no sly baby waywardness that was going to inch away as with baby fat, baby curl, and baby spot rash. The pendulous lip, the branching ears, the eyes so wide and wild, the vague, unvibrant brown of the skin, and, most disturbing, the great head. These components of that look bespoke the sure fiber, the deep grain. His father could not bear the sight of him. His mother high-piled her pretty dyed hair and put him among her hairpins and sweethearts, dance slippers, torn paper roses. Although he was not less than these, he was not more. As the little Lincoln grew, uglily upward and out, he began to understand that something was wrong. His little ways of trying to please his father, the bringing of matches, the jumping aside at warning sound of oh-so-large and rushing stride, the smile that gave and gave and gave, unsuccessful. Even Christmases and Easters were spoiled. He would be sitting at the family feasting table, really delighting in the displays of mashed potatoes and the rich golden fat crust of the ham or the festive fowl, when he would look up and find somebody feeling indignant about him. What a pity, what a pity. No love for one so loving. The little Lincoln loved everybody. Ants, the changing caterpillar, his much missing mother. His kindergarten teacher, whose concern for him was composed of one part sympathy and two parts repulsion. The others ran up with their little drawings. He ran up with his. She tried to be as pleasant with him as with others, but it was difficult, for she was all beauty, all daintiness, all tiny vanilla, with blue eyes and fluffy sun hair. One afternoon, she saw him in the hall looking very bleak against the wall. It was strange because the bell had long since rung and no other child was in sight. Pity flooded her. She buttoned her gloves and suggested cheerfully that she walk him home. She started out bravely, holding him by the hand, but she had not walked far before she regretted it. The little monkey, must everyone look? And clutching her hand like that, literally pinching it. At 7, the little Lincoln loved the brother and sister who moved next door, handsome, well-dressed, charitable often to him. They enjoyed him because he was resourceful, made up stories, played games. But when their more acceptable friends came, they turned their handsome backs on him. He hated himself for responding gratefully to their later, "Hi, Link," hated himself for his feeling of well-being when with them, despite everything. He spent much time looking at himself in mirrors. What could be done? But there was no shrinking his head. There was no binding his ears. "Don't touch me," cried the little fairy-like being in the playground. Her name was Nerissa. The many children were playing tag, but when he caught her, she recoiled, jerked free, and ran. It was like all the rainbow that ever was, going off forever, all the sparklings in the sunset west. One day while he was yet 7, a thing happened. In the downtown movies with his mother, a white man in the seat beside him whispered loudly to a companion and pointed at the little Link. "There. That's the kind I've been wanting to show you. One of the best examples of the species. Not like those deluded Negroes you see so much of in the streets these days, but the real thing. Black, ugly, and odd. You can see the savagery, the blunt blankness. That is the real thing. His mother, her dyed hair had never looked so red around the dark brown velvet of her face, jumped up, shrieked, "Go to, go." She did not finish. She yanked to his feet the little Lincoln, who was sitting there staring in fascination at his assessors, at the author of his new idea. All the way home, he was happy. Of course, he had not liked the word ugly, but after all, should he not be used to that by now? What had struck him among words and meanings he could little understand was the phrase, the real thing. He didn't know quite why, but he liked that. He liked that very much. When he was hurt, too much stared at, too much left alone, he thought about that. He told himself, after all, I'm the real thing. It comforted him. For almost 4 years, it meant a lot to him. The beginnings of Black pride, as you see. In this book, In the Mecca, which came out in 68, I have as the title poem an 812-line thing called In the Mecca. And I imagine I'll never write anything that long again, although it set out to be 2,000 lines long, but somehow I stopped before reaching that golden end. The poem is based on life in an old building in Chicago that was torn down about 54, and you might, I'm certainly not going to read you this poem, don't shiver in your seats there. But perhaps you'd be interested in knowing a little of the background for it. When I got out of junior college, I had to get a job, and I went to the Illinois State Employment Service and applied, and presently they furnished me with a secretarial post in the Mecca building. And they didn't tell me that my employer was a spiritual advisor, but thus it was. And when I got there, I saw this little man who looked very poor, but he was very rich indeed. And he had five secretaries, including myself, and we were kept busy typing sheets of lucky numbers and clipping them out and putting one apiece in, inside the letters that we had to write to his many, 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 many clients. And I had another job. I had to bottle bright liquids and box bright powders. And these had fascinating names, such as drawing and holding powder, attraction powder, black cat powder, powerful serum, marvelous potency number 91, which stoppeth husbands and lovers from dastardy, paycheck fluid, running around elixir, policy number compeller, voodoo potion. And I had to deliver these through the building, and that gave me my opportunity to get acquainted with that great mesh-mash of humanity quartered there. One of the inmates said this, "How many people live here? 2,000? Oh, more than that. There's 176 apartments, and some of them's got 7 rooms, and they're all full." And indeed, toward the end of this building's history, it was rumored that perhaps 2,000 people were inside there. And it was a huge building, 4 stories high, and it took up most of a city block. Well, what I want to read to you is a little batch of poems from the second half of the book, which is called After Mecca, and deals with contemporary matters. First, let me read Malcolm X. That name still is responsible for shivers up and down the spine of many people. But one thing that most of his enemies and friends have granted him was manhood. He represented maleness, manhood. And I tried to put that into this poem. Original, ragged round, rich, robust. He had the hawk man's eyes. We gasped. We saw the maleness raking out and making guttural the air and pushing us to walls, and in a soft and fundamental hour, a sorcery, devout and vertical, beguiled the world. He opened us, who was a key, who was a man. And those of you who have forgotten about the quality of Malcolm X might refresh your memory by looking at Black Journal this Monday, I believe, at about 9 o'clock on your channel, I think it's 13, and you'll see Malcolm X telling you of his philosophy and motivation. In Chicago, I don't know how many of you are familiar with Chicago. Whenever I mention Chicago, almost anywhere I go, faces freeze. But there we have a phenomenon, the Chicago Picasso. And I'm sure most of you have heard of this anyway. And when I was asked by a mayor who is famous throughout the world by now, Mayor Richard J. Daley, to write a poem about the Picasso to be read on dedication day, I giggled over the telephone because I had seen pictures of this thing, and it looked so strange that I couldn't imagine what in the world I could say about it in a poem. So I decided not to tackle the Picasso, but to speak of art itself and the way that people who are not well versed in it respond to it. It seems like a not huggable kind of thing, something somewhat beyond us, perhaps above us. And we look at it with respect, but we don't reach out and grab it. Does man love art? Man visits art, but squirms. Art hurts. Art urges voyages. And it is easier to stay at home, the nice beer ready. In common rooms, we belch or sniff or scratch, are raw. But we must cook ourselves and style ourselves for art, who is a requiring courtesan. We squirm. We do not hug the Mona Lisa. We may touch or tolerate an astounding fountain or a horse and rider, at most another lion. Observe the tall cold of a flower, which is as innocent and as guilty, as meaningful and as meaningless as any other flower in the western field. But when the blue cloth was taken off the Picasso, I was very glad it was there. It has a strange, ungainly kind of grace, and I consider it, and many others consider it, a mind extender. That's always good. There's another phenomenon in Chicago called the wall of respect. And right across the street from it now is the wall of truth. This makes a very colorful corner on 43rd and Langley on the south side. But the wall of respect, as Ebony described it, the side wall of a typical slum building on the corner of 43rd and Langley, became a mural communicating Black dignity. The young Black painters and photographers of Chicago decided that they wanted to choose and celebrate their own heroes. And so they chose such people as Malcolm X, of course, W.E.B. Du Bois, Lerone Bennett, the Chicago historian, and Muhammad Ali, and Claudia McNeil, and a little group of Muslims. And believe it or not, I am there. And these are the people who were celebrated, and others, on Dedication Day, which also was in August of 1967. And I wanted to, that was such an exciting day with people in the streets singing and dancing and, as I say in this poem, chanting their poetry. And this is my little dedication to the dedication. A drum, 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 humbly we come, south of success and east of gloss and glass, our sandals, flower cloth, grave hoops of wood or gold, pendant from black ears, brown ears, reddish brown and ivory ears. Black boymen on roofs, fist out. Black power, Val, a little black stampede in African images of brass and flowers swirl, fists out. Black power tightens pretty eyes, leans back on mother country, and is tracked, is treatise, through her perfect and tight teeth. Women in wool hair chant their poetry. Phil Coran gives us messages and music made of developed bone and polished and honed cult. It is the hour of tribe and of vibration, the day-long hour. It is the hour of ringing rowls of ferment festival. On 43rd and Langley, black furnaces resent ancient legislatures of ploy and scruple and practical gelatin. They keep the fever in, fondle the fever, all worship the wall. I mount the rattling wood. Walter says, she is good, says she our sister is. In front of me, hundreds of faces, red, brown, brown, black, ivory, yield me hot trust, their yea and their announcement that they are ready to rile the high-flung ground. Behind me, paint, heroes. No child has defiled the heroes of this wall, this serious appointment, this still wing, this scald, this flute, this heavy light, this hinge. An emphasis is parole. The old decapitations are revised, the dispossessions beakless, and we sing. I wonder if here in Poughkeepsie there is any such horrible phenomenon as boys running around breaking windows, seemingly with no reason. A great deal of this goes on in the larger cities, and this poem, Boy Breaking Glass, attempts not to excuse them, but to interpret what their feelings would be, again, if they could translate those feelings. Whose broken window is a cry of art, success that winks aware as elegance, as a treasonable faith, is raw, is sonic, is old-eyed premiere, our beautiful flaw and terrible ornament, our barbarous and metal little man. I shall create, if not a note, a whole, if not an overture, a desecration, full of pepper and light and salt and night and cargoes. Don't go down the plank if you see there's no extension. Each to his grief, each to his loneliness and fidgety revenge. Nobody knew where I was, and now I am no longer there. The only sanity is a cup of tea. The music is in minors. Each one other is having different weather. It was you who threw away my name. And this is everything I have for me. Who has not Congress, lobster, love, luau, the Regency Room, the Statue of Liberty, runs a sloppy amalgamation, a mistake, a cliff, a hymn, a snare, and an exceeding sun. In Detroit, there is a small publishing company called the Broadside Press, and I have a great deal of admiration for the single man who is the Broadside Press, Dudley Randall, a poet himself, and he is giving a platform to a good many young black poets of today who otherwise would have had no commercial platform. And of course, indeed, these young poets, many of them, will not send their manuscripts to such publishing companies as Harper's and Macmillan and Houghton Mifflin anymore, because they prefer to be brought out by a black press. And just recently, Broadside Press brought out a new little book of mine, a three-part poem called Riot. And for an interested two or three of you. I shall have some copies to give after this presentation. The title poem I'd like to read, Riot. A riot is the language of the unheard, said Martin Luther King. And right after the riot which followed Martin Luther King's assassination in Chicago, I wanted to write a poem about it and got my inspiration when I saw on page 3 of our Sun Times a large photograph of a great throng of youngsters, young black youngsters, coming down Madison Avenue, which was pretty much destroyed. And they looked so vital and vigorous and ready to take on almost any challenge. And I wondered how a white liberal, young white liberal, old white liberal, might have felt being confronted by this throng. And here is my liberal. Of course, as you'll understand, he was not a liberal. He was not liberal at all. He merely had felt that he was. John Cabot, out of Wilma, once a Wycliffe, all white blue rose below his golden hair, wrapped richly in right linen and right wool, almost forgot his Jaguar and Lake Bluff, almost forgot Grand Tully, which is the best thing that ever happened to Scotch, almost forgot the sculpture at the Richard Gray and Distelheim, the kidney pie at Maxim's, the Grenadine de Boeuf at Maison Henri, because the Negroes were coming down the street, because the poor were sweaty and unpretty, not like two dainty Negroes in Winnetka, and they were coming toward him in rough ranks, in seas, in windsweep. They were black and loud and not detainable and not discreet. Gross, gross, catue, grossier. John Cabot itched instantly beneath the nourished white that told his story of glory to the world. Don't let it touch me, the blackness, Lord, he whispered to any handy angel in the sky. But in a thrilling announcement, on it drove and breathed on him and touched him. In that breath, the fume of Pigfoot, Chitterling, and Cheechily malign mocked John. And in terrific touch, old averted doubt jerked forward decently, cried, Cabot, John, you are a desperate man, and the desperate die expensively today. John Cabot went down in the smoke and fire and broken glass and blood, and he cried, Lord, forgive these niggas that know not what they do. Thank you. Well, now I want to read a few of the poems of some young black poets today. One of the most important is Don Lee. Oh, somebody knows him here. And in an introduction to his book, Don't Cry, Scream, I said, he knows that the black man today must ride full face into the whirlwind with small regard for, quote, correctness, with limited concern for the possibilities of error. He knows that there are briefs, even for the big mistake, and that's in capitals, the big mistake is at least a violent change, and in the center of a violent change are the seeds of creation. And this that follows represents so much of what the young writers of today feel. Don Lee knows that nothing human is elegant. He is not interested in modes of writing that aspire to elegance. He is well acquainted with elegant literature, but while certainly respecting the advantages and influence of good workmanship, he is not interested in supplying the needs of the English departments at Harvard and Oxford, nor the editors of Partisan Review. although he could mightily serve as fact factory for these. He speaks to blacks hungry for what they themselves refer to as real poetry. These blacks find themselves and the stuff of their existence in his healthy, live, lusty reaches of free verse. The last thing these people crave is elegance. It is very hard to enchant with elegant song the ears of a fellow whose stomach is growling. He can't hear you. The more interesting noise is too loud. Well,